About 7 years ago or so, the board for Holden Village, in their wisdom, chose to form a science and technology committee that would respond to their needs for this kind of input for various projects, or as we say in my home country, projects. As my uncle says, it took him 5 years to learn how to say government. No, it took him 5 years to learn how to say job. Then they changed it to government project. And we have worked on a large number of things, and the members of the committee, it's kind of a fluid group, but there's a central core of, I've lost count, 40 or 50. No, not really. There's usually a 10 or 15 that show up for our meetings. We have official meetings twice a year, in June and September. That's when they can more easily accommodate us here at the village because of room. We have other meetings too because we're very scriptural. Wherever two or three are gathered, we have a meeting. So we have a lot of consultation among the people here. And there are many challenges for such a group because we have big problems. Transportation, generation of energy, sewage, waste, and to help the Forest Service deal with a very big problem having to do with the tailings, which are not on our property. We have property here too, owned by us. We own the buildings and also some land where the mining claims are. And so we must be good stewards of that. And so we help you as members of guests of Holden to fulfill our responsibilities in stewardship. We take this very seriously, although our meetings have a good deal of levity. We have relatively short meetings, and I can say with all honesty that you really couldn't afford, the Holden Board couldn't afford to bring together this group of consultants that we meet with me twice a year if you had to pay what the going rate is for these kind of people. You just couldn't afford it. And they give very generously of their time to address very serious problems. And we have some very serious problems. Some of them we've licked, and we have some very big ones before us. And to start things out, I'm going to ask Werner Jansen, who has been here since 19-odd, I've forgotten when, but he's been here a long time, although he's still a very young man. And he came here to us from Boeing. He's in aeronautical engineering out of PU. That's Purdue University.
PS for PU.
And I've asked him to give you sort of a history, because I don't want to cheat you out of getting a little history tonight, because that was the announced subject.
Right.
But he's going to give you a little history, especially of the generating, electrical generating history of this place, which is very interesting, sort of when it was formed. And then the latest project, which Hugh Davis and others who helped him, Bill Matheson and Dave Larson, But Dave has spent, I mean, literally months on an alternate proposal for electrical generation. Hugh Davis, what did I say? Dave. Okay, Hugh Davis. And Dave Larson. And I can't even remember my own name sometimes. So that's why the I can't do anything else, so they have me run the meetings. And the reason they have me run chair this committee is that I bring Kruger Gold cheese to every meeting. Now they're planning to get rid of me because they're hearing I'm moving to Seattle away from the source of Kruger Gold cheese. And I also sometimes bring them flatbread. That's flatbread, it's Norwegian. It's even better than my mother used to make. But they're mad at me because I didn't bring any this time. I just got in from Australia and I didn't have time to make it. And my wife wouldn't help me. So that's why we're eating kangaroo jerky. So with that inauspicious introduction, we're going to have Werner Jansen, who has been executive director, executive business manager for Holden Village for as long as I can remember. That isn't saying very much.
Actually, I just retired, so I'm no longer a business manager. You forgot that. So.
Well, you're still a consultant.
Oh, yeah. Well, just a little bit of history. During the mine days, the House Sound Company brought in power for the mining operation from the PUD in Chelan. They didn't have their own hydroelectric or any type of generating facilities other than a backup diesel plant. The village, when it first got started in 1961, contacted the PUD and asked them what it would take to reactivate the lines and the transformer distribution system into the village. The lines were still up and basically usable, but the distribution system had, or the transformers had been removed, salvaged. At that time, the PUD came up with a proposal that would cost the village about $40,000 to reactivate the lines. And at that that time, too, they informed the village that, as was the case with the mine, that the power would be metered in Chelan or Manson, and we would be paying for the line losses, which I understand from the mine wasn't a great factor, but of course they used a great deal of electricity, and we wouldn't have. Then we would have also been responsible for the line maintenance, from Manson or Chelan up here, and this would have been a tremendous cost for the village. Also, of course, we would have been paying for the electricity at a reasonable rate. It's still, I think, in Chelan County, one of the least expensive power rates in the country. At Stehekin, I think it's up now to about 5 or 6 cents a kilowatt. In Chelan, it's still a cent and a half or 1.6 cents. So it's still very, very inexpensive. At that point, the board or the village decided to install two diesel electric generators just so that the village could have some electricity more or less immediately. The summer of 1961, if any of you were here that summer, there was no electricity all through the summer. The first crews came in and lived primarily out of Chalet 1, cooked on a cook stove and a fireplace out in back of Chalet 1. And the few guests that would come were paying workers, by and large, because everybody that came in those days ended up doing some work and enjoying it. By the end of that summer, 1961, the diesel electric plants had been installed. And in fact, that's the first time that I came to the village, was for the dedication of those diesel plants. It was the last weekend in September of 61. And I think 30 people showed up for the well-publicized dedication service. Some of you are from Seattle. You might remember Stan Morrison, who was on television for a number of years with his faithful dog. And he had a children's Norwegian ethnic show. And
he also played an accordion.
Yeah, he played an accordion. And he was the entertainment for the dedication of the diesel electric plants. Pastor Brown, from who was at Finney Ridge at that time, was the dedication pastor. And it was typical dedication. We met in the village center, and again, there were just 30 of us, and there were no lights in there. It was in the afternoon, so there was just enough light coming through the windows to see. And Reuben Thompson, who was the caretaker at that time, and Gil Berg, who was the director and manager, were down at the diesel plant getting them all fired up and had it all timed so that when Pastor Brown said the right word, then the lights would come on. And as always happens under those circumstances, nothing happened. And after about 15 minutes of more accordion music and Norwegian jokes, Gail came back and informed us that a wire had burned off at the generator someplace and there would be a slight delay. So another half hour passed and finally the lights did come on.
Reuben had a dog, Bugger, didn't he?
Yeah, Bugger, yeah, yeah. Anyway, that was really the start of electric power in the village. And because of the cost of diesel fuel at that time, which was tremendously high at, I think, 15 cents a gallon, we only used the electric plants about, it was from like 5:30 or 6 in the morning until 10:30 at night. Reuben would go down and put on the diesel at about 5:30 so the kitchen stoves could heat up. And then at 10:30 at night, they went off, and the rest of the time, there was no electricity at all in the village. And it actually became almost an institution. People enjoyed it so much that better conversations took place after 10:30 than before. And, you know, if you had a flashlight, you were able to get around the village. Otherwise, you made sure you were in bed by 10:30. Otherwise, you went around on hands and knees trying to find where you lived. And when a couple of years later, the hydro plant got started then in 1963, the first dozer work was done at the existing plant. By August of 64, the first electricity was being produced by the new hydro plant. And then the big discussion in the village and even on the board, and it was a serious discussion, you know, is it possible to wire the thing so that we can turn it off at 10:30? Or have one set of wires coming in to activate the compressors for the kitchen, but the rest of the village would be dark? And it was really a serious discussion at that time. Finally, the insurance agent actually won out and said that they've been tolerant all these years, or the 3 or 4 years when we didn't have electricity, but they thought if we wanted to keep relatively low liability rates, that we better have electricity on 24 hours a day, so that settled that. There was a committee very similar to the science committee that put together the original hydro plant. They found the equipment over in Idaho at an irrigation system. The equipment had been sitting idle for some 20 years. A family from Eastern Washington, the Sheffels, they bought the equipment, all the hydro equipment, the generators, the turbines, a lot of the electrical panel, and the governors for $1,500. And then they gave it to the village. And the whole plant was installed at that time for less than $40,000. And it was all done on a volunteer basis, with the exception of one man who was a marvelous individual, Henry Schwecke, who was a lover of hydroelectric projects, much like Hugh Davis, and but not a formally trained engineer, but was one of these guys that you know could do anything and did everything and rebuilt a lot of the equipment that was lost from the hydro plant. Came up here and supervised the volunteers. All of the cement was poured with one of those little cement mixers, day after day, you know, pouring one wheelbarrow at a time. The pipeline, a 14-inch steel pipeline, was put up up to the lower diversion dam initially, up by the water tank. It was hooked into the old pipe at that point. And initially, then, out of the 200 kilowatts that the one unit would produce, I think we got about 100 kilowatts because it was way below the design of the plant itself. 2 years later, then, a new diversion dam was started, and 2,000 more feet of pipe was put in to the upper diversion dam, and that again was done on a volunteer basis. The Swiss loggers who were in the valley at that time volunteered their Caterpillar to build the road up to the diversion dam. Again, the cement work, everything, a lot of the aggregate for the cement work for that diversion dam was hauled up in the back of the old Jeep, if you can imagine, you know, bits of loads at a time. The pipeline was, the 14-inch pipe was installed with the old bomb truck that's still around the village. Each section weighed 1,000 pounds, a half a ton, and was 40 feet long. And we figured out a way to hoist each section up on the side of the bomb truck, and it was a four-wheel drive vehicle, go up the hill to where the last pipe was laid and lower it down and slide it into place with manpower. It was really building the pyramids all over, really. And so it was a great day when the hydro plant finally went online in August of 63, and then the second section of the new diversion dam was completed in August of 66.
And I'd like to interject here. Wasn't it some church in Toledo, Ohio that gave us $4,000?
Yeah, that
out of the blue to help with this.
Yeah, they'd heard of Bolden Village, but they were the ones that, in a sense, sort of kicked off the little bit of fundraising that was necessary to complete the plant. So, there's a lot of things in the village, in the history of the village, that you can go through and say, well, this was critical. You know, without this, you know, the village wouldn't have flown. I think that's the proper word, isn't it?
Something like that.
Airborne.
But, you know, the hydro is, I think, one of those because, if you do look, we've been using about 1 million kilowatt hours of electricity in the recent history per year. And based on, 6 cents a kilowatt hour, which I'm sure we would be paying probably more than that, this would be $60,000 a year that we would be paying. And I personally don't think the village would have survived if we would have had to pay that electrical bill plus everything else that the village needed to purchase. So in a very real sense, that little hydro plant at $39,000, was the lifeblood of the village and did allow the village to exist very inexpensively, so that our electricity over these 22 years has been water cheap, literally. So, that enough history.
That's pretty good. Now, if you were going to bid this project, of the present plant, what would it be? I got all these civil engineers here. I've been told up to $30 million.
Well, even at that time, in those early years, I would go around and show pictures of the village, promoting the village, and I had some pictures of the hydro. And I remember in Seattle at one program that there was a contractor there, and he refused to believe that it was done with volunteer labor. He just says, I know what it's like. You can't do it. Don't tell me you did it. it can't be done. And he said at that time it would be at least $250,000, and that was in 1963. So it would be more than that. Yeah. Now that.
And my kids were also involved in it, painting the tar on the pipes. Everybody was in the act. So all of those people. That's why it's so very dear to them. Because they contributed to it. See, they contributed their work effort to it.
When did the second unit, was it bought at the same time?
Well, yeah, both units were installed at the same time.
Oh.
And but initially the lower diversion dam was all that we had available. And so it was only what we call unit number one that was operable for many years, actually until Hugh came along. When did you first come up here?
Oh, about 6 years ago.
Yeah. We had... We of course hoped to use both units, and the second unit we had problems with the buckets. They kept falling off, and we had all new buckets made, and that still didn't work properly. And so we finally went to the expense, which was about $20,000, of having a whole new runner and buckets cast and by the Luffel Company in Ohio. And even after we put that on, it still was very inefficient. And a fellow who came up here, thought that probably it was just a misalignment problem. And then Hugh came one day, not even knowing that Holden Village existed, and Hugh and Melba were coming up lake and heard somebody talk about the village, I guess, and decided to take the chance and see what was up here. And they came up, and as soon as Hugh found out there was a hydro plant here, he started to drool. And proceeded to figure out a very inexpensive way of aligning the hydro plant, and now the number two unit is our most efficient unit. So this is the way things happen at the village, and it's...
So Hugh and Melba, hold up your hands so they know what you're on. All right, so that's just one of the things that we've done. Another thing is try to make things more efficient. For those of you who worked in the kitchen, you know that we run a lot of hot water down through there, and that costs money. And so using heat transfer units, instead of having the water come in from the creek at 40 degrees, by heat transfer, I guess it's now coming in at 106.
Yeah, taking the wastewater from the dishwater, commercial dishwasher, the old Hobart. Well, it's not old, but we call it the old Hobart.
Term of endearment.
Yeah. It requires by law to rinse the dishes with 180-degree water, and this takes a lot of energy to get it up to 180 degrees from 40. And then, it rinses a second or two, and then it goes down the drain. Well, there's a lot of energy left. and we made a homemade heat exchanger that fits into the wastewater, or the drain of the dishwater, and then so it now preheats the water before it goes into the boiler. So just that little homemade heat exchanger brings the water from 40 degrees up to 100 or 106 degrees, so the boiler only has to bring it up another, you know, 70 degrees instead of 140, and that in itself saves a lot of oil.
And we got solar panels up in the hospital that heat the water for the
laundry
in the summer, and there also we had some solar panels out at the sauna. Are they?
Yeah, they were the first ones that we built years ago through a student project at Washington State University. We offered a scholarship to a young student. This was really before solar was very popular.
Before it was invented.
You didn't even use sunglasses.
And we've been worrying about tailings a lot, and try to do some with them. We have a soil scientist on our committee, Al Halverson. He has a plot right in front of Coineo where you've noticed that it's tailings growing flowers in it. He showed us how to do that. And so you can add lime, a lot of things. If you walk up there, you'll see a lot of things happening. It really started happening when we started to spray sewage on it. Sewage effluent really makes it grow. Even on tailings. And one of the things we're working on up there, because we got a show and tell here for you, but you got to make it short because we got to get the management plan for the timber and stuff.
Yeah, well,
somebody came up with the idea of Jerusalem artichokes. And we got a still now. And we're not going to tell you where it is.
Art Volste squeezed the first few ounces of juice from our Jerusalem artichokes. It looks more like the sewage water to me.
That's right.
He claims it's the squeezings of the artichokes.
Now, I tasted it, and it is.
You're under weeds, and how much you know?
But the artichokes seem to do quite well up there. They're very tolerant to wide range of pH soils, which we have a wide range up there, primarily on the low scale. and the artichokes are very good for producing fuel alcohol, so that's our hope that maybe in a few years our production will have to go up a little bit. this is at least hope for the future. Maybe our buses will be powered by fuel alcohol that's irrigated with the sewage. That's rehabilitating the tailings, so that's something to look forward to.
So when the buses hiccup, we'll know why.
That's right.
This is Bill Giddings, who's one of the chemists on our program from PLU. Now, we're also looking at producer gas. And Mark, can you give us a real short rundown on that?
Producer gas is carbon monoxide.
Can you hear him back there?
Yeah,
okay.
You gotta speak loudly.
Darn, I have to get up. Producer gas is using the smoke from an incompletely burned wood. Is basically what it is. You take and get a fire started in your wood, and then tighten it up and put a little water on it, and you come off with carbon monoxide, a little hydrogen, a little bit of methane, but it will burn. And this is nothing new. It's been going on for quite some time. During the First World War, they had trucks running around with a great big fireplace on the back end of the truck, and as I understand it, is quite a smelly operation. But they still did function, particularly in Germany, and they were also used during the Second World War, as attested to by our fearless leader. He was involved where they had producer gas trucks that were utilized. Well, we do have what you would call wood waste that can be utilized stove that in which you produce the producer gas, and this can be fed into through the carburetor of a ordinary vehicle, and it will you can run the car on this material. The older the car, the better it works, because the thing has to be real loose in order to function. But we do have plans for the construction of a car-sized unit, but so far we haven't been able to get a mechanic that has enough time to put the thing together. But this will come.
Thank you. You see, why we're looking at this and methyl alcohol production and this kind of thing is that if you'll just think back a few years ago when the gas shortage hit us, and we're not exactly high priority on the gas line when it comes down to the crunch, and if we're going to keep functioning, we better have some alternate plans. And that's why we're working on these kind of things, and that's why we're looking at, also, we'd like to get off hydrocarbon fuels, and that's why we're looking at these energy-generating projects. And that's why I'm going to have you and Hugh talk a little bit, but I thought we'd have the management plan and finish up with the generators. Is that all right? And then I'll introduce the rest of the committee. But Dave, could you give us a little rundown? Dave is a timber baron, and he hasn't got his red suspenders on tonight, but he usually wears them. And he's our business and economics advisor, and he buys ice cream cones at the breaks for us.
I'm working my way up here. Tell them what Paul Fanning suggested we do this.
All right, yeah, I have to tell you, that's why I asked how many were here. Paul, the late Paul Fanning was a fantastic guy. He left school at the age of 16, and he accumulated some resource. And this was one of his favorite places. He was a Presbyterian. He's a fallen away Lutheran. He joined the Presbyterian Church, and he was one of our biggest supporters. And he was a man of many great ideas. And his proposal, you see, we've gone through a lot of things on the tailings. A lot of people suggested, you know, everybody that comes up here, if they take a sack of them out,
they're
going to be gone. Well, it turns out that we really need them for some things now, But they're a problem. Some of you were here a few days ago, blowing all over the place, and it isn't exactly healthy for the life around here, and especially the plants and stuff down below and the creek and everything. But what he suggested was first you build an egg timer, you see, and put tailings in it, and like 3 minute or 5 minute, you know, and people would buy these. And then his greatest idea, that wouldn't take it fast enough. So he thought that he'd make an 18-minute sermon timer to all the churches. And the churches would put a pretty high price on them. And all the churches feel guilty about it, so they'd have to get them. And we'd probably be the only tailings pile in the world that we'd have to start up the mine to make more tailings. These sermon timers. So that was his idea. Can you expand on that? I wish he could still come up here, but his spirit still reigns supreme here. And I guess that story will be told as long as people come here. And it's true.
Golden Holden.
Yeah, that's right. He called them the Golden Holden
Sermon
Timers. Golden Holden. We have an exciting proposal here on timber management for the valley.
We're very serious about our projects.
Yes, we have a certain amount of levity, but we don't take ourselves very seriously, but we take you seriously.
Yes. If you look around at the environment in which Holden exists, one of the things that's most apparent is the marvelous natural resource in the timber. And while the program of Holden isn't only arts and crafts and lectures and so on, it's the management of the environment in which we live. up to recent years, Holden has been pretty much a consumer of the forest products around us. We think that good stewardship dictates that we also be managers of this forest, and that if future generations are going to benefit as we have from the forest, that we're going to have to put something back into it. As you ride up here from Lucerne to the village, you probably observed that it's a very mature stand of trees. It's an over-mature forest. If you walk down to the bridge at Tenmouth Creek, you probably observed that a lot of the trees are dying from the tops. Now, in recent years, Holden has been able to buy wood from the Forest Service at very reasonable rates, and what we've taken out is the mortality in the forest. We've been using about 100 cords of firewood a year and about 15,000 board feet of sawlogs. As you probably noticed, we have our own mill here. So much of the paneling that has been done in the lodges and so on has been cut with our own mill.
This in here was cut here.
As you can see, we'll do a really fine job. We don't think that the use of wood for fuel is the ultimate solution for Holden Village. We think it's more an interim solution until alternative methods of energy, such as were described earlier, will be developed and installed at Holden Village. The land between the village and Lucerne is U.S. Forest Service managed land, and it's part of the Wenatchee National Forest. Holden itself owns about 200 acres of the old mining claims that were given to the village by House Island Mining Company. The lower elevations are good timberland, but there aren't too many acres of that, so that we are pretty much holding that in reserve for future use. Our main source of wood is from the Forest Service land. Well, the Forest Service in recent years developed a management plan for the Entiat area, and they gave us a copy of that about 3 years ago, and suggested that they'd be absolutely delighted if Holden would do the work on developing a similar plan for the corridor from the village down to Lucerne. And we were fortunate in having available a couple of forestry students from the University of Washington, and over the last couple of years they produced this thick document, which we have now available for use as a guide in managing that corridor. The Forest Service stressed to us that we must consider a multiple use plan rather than a timber plan. Here, one of the biggest impacts of the forest is the visual impact. And so one of the things we tried to do was identify those areas that would offer scenic vistas. And if we were going to take trees out, that we might always have in mind the impact of the removal of the trees. In other words, will it open up a view or will it look like a bare clear-cut area? Another thing that was stressed to us that we must have in mind is the impact on the wildlife. Another one is on water quality, recreation. You probably saw some hunters come through the village this evening. Was it mules they were riding?
Yeah, the trail crew.
Trail crew, okay. went through the ballpark. But this time of the year we do have hunters coming through here, so recreation is another use. So we then drew on the resources of the experts in those areas other than just timber. But we also examined things like the supply of timber, the age of the timber, the rate at which it was dying, and so on. At this elevation, the timber is probably on about a 200-year rotation. And when you have that long a rotation at this high elevation, the Forest Service suggested that we not harvest at a rate faster than a 300-year rotation. When we inventoried the timber, which is the first time this had really been done in this area, we concluded that it would be possible to continue our present rate of use indefinitely. In other words, the growth and the mortality will be enough to provide the present rate of use into the indefinite future. And that was a comforting thought. In other words, we're not over-harvesting this corridor. As a matter of fact, it's probably dying off at a faster rate than we've been using it presently. In the future, I'm hoping that we will have the resources also to add something back for the next rotation. An example would be the Miner's Village. When the Miner's Village was bulldozed and burned, nothing was done about replanting it. And so, as you can observe, it's growing back in brush. Now, if nature were to run its course, that greasewood there would probably catch on fire and burn. And then the next crop of conifers would get started. Around Holda Village, we absolutely cannot tolerate a fire that close to the village. And so we're going to have to give nature an assist and probably clear that brush and replant that area. The types of projects that probably could be done in the way of timber management all lend themselves very easily to the type of volunteer help that we have. In other words, you don't have to be a graduate forester to get out and plant those small trees. We've done a certain amount of it right around the village. Unfortunately, again, when man intrudes into an area, you change the natural cycle a little bit. We have such a tame crop of deer around here that in the spring, when the snow is first gone but the leaves are not yet budded out on the other trees, they just love those little pine seedlings. And so I'm not sure we've kept ahead of the deer so far. But we'll keep working at it. And hopefully, as long as there is a Holda Village, and even if we were to leave this location, hopefully we would be able to say we left the forest in better shape than we found it.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, I'm going to introduce the rest of the committee, and then we'll spend the rest of the time on the hydro project very rapidly. I have introduced Mark Adams. I have introduced Russ Adams. Here he is. He's sanitary engineering and related subject. He's looking at tailings and what we should be doing there. Terrell Chang, in the red shirt back there, big help to us in many areas. Engineering and others, and I'll go through it alphabetically here. Some of the people are not here. Hugh Davis, we've already introduced. Dave Dornis, an energy expert from Livermore, California, is not here. Rudy Edmond, many of you know him, he is not here. Ellen Gamrath, who's president of the board, is ex officio. Bill Giddings, I've already introduced. I've already introduced Al Halverson. Where's Dorothy? Well, here's Dorothy. She's a nutrition consultant for us from Washington State University. Linda Hines is not here. Dave Larson, you've already heard. Bill Matheson is right here, physicist in electrical engineering and consults on many of our subjects. Jim Scrindy is a civil engineer back there. And his older brother is my roommate in college, Ray Scrindy. Or I guess he's his father, that's right. He looks like his older brother, but he's his father. Roy Vernstrom is not here. He's an expert on water. And then we have many other consultants. Who have I left off? Bill Madden sat with us through this. A lot of people who have a discipline that is helpful sit in on our meetings, and they are open to anyone that wants to come. Is that fair enough? Have we mentioned it? Werner is a member of the committee. So now Werner and Hugh are going to finish off telling about the present projects, the one that you've applied for permission and the alternative we're looking at.
And maybe we can just give some real quick information, and there might be a few minutes left for some questions. has one, you can let us know. Or any other kind of sorghum mill. Sorghum isn't real popular in this area, but if you have a mill sitting around, let us know. In order to increase our hydroelectric production, we've been looking over a period of years, especially for winter use. Copper Creek decreases considerably in volume, well, even starting now. That's why we've had a number of outages each day. And we have less water than we can use, and we need more electricity than we have. So we've been looking at various alternatives. One of the possibilities is down on Railroad Creek at 7 Mile, where there would be a diversion point there, a plant about 5,000 feet further down the creek. We've actually applied for a preliminary permit and received that for that study. We don't have any construction permits. We've done some of the study necessary for the other permits, such as the archaeological survey down there. They didn't find anything, so that's not a hurdle. Also, a mineral survey down there, and a few things like this that are necessary by the government to get the permits from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. At the same time, we're looking at other alternatives, and Hugh Davis has come up with now, I think it's titled Alternative 12B, or 12. The really exciting and interesting thing about this project is that it's local right here at the village again. And the whole project would be confined to an area that's already disturbed by the previous history mine operation. It's sort of a modified pump storage system, if you're familiar with that type, where he's done considerable calculations and has come up with a system where the upper overburden or slag pile, not the tailings, but if you're up on the upper mine level, you know there's two distinct piles of rock. And on the east pile are creating about a 100 acre feet storage at that point. Having a small diversion down on Railroad Creek close to the ballpark or the horse corral, which part of it's on our property. Water would be pumped up from there up to the storage facility, and then a penstock, a pipeline, would bring the water back down to the plant, which would be located just down below tailings number 3. And he's again gone through extensive calculations to show that the system will work. It is a very viable project. We haven't started any permits for this system. There are still a lot of information that we have to get, partially such as excavation of the rock pile, you know, the integrity of that. It would take a liner to retain the water in it. There's a potential problem on Railroad Creek at this elevation of how much water we would need to pump up, and the state, the Department of Ecology, requires that there's a certain base flow left into the creek at all times for the good of the fish. And if they require more than we're able to live with, of course that would kill the project too. So there's a number of hurdles that need to be dealt with, but it's an exciting project. We wouldn't need to build power lines back to the village, the 4 miles that are associated with the other project. Cost-wise, we haven't done a cost analysis of it yet, but very likely we'll be in the same ballpark as the 7 Mile project, which probably will be around $700,000 compared with the $40,000 that we built our first plant, so it's a little frightening in that way. But and either project will, of course, require a fundraising by the village, and really the first time the village has ever had a fundraising project in the 22 years that we've been in existence. The village is still debt-free, and maybe even as we approach that project, we hope that we can raise sufficient funds that will still be debt-free. Hugh, do you want to say any more about that project?
Yeah, I have some good news to announce. Just pushing a pencil around saves $25,000.
Oh, good.
Did you write a check?
Yeah, do you want another pencil? I want another pencil.
Seriously, you know, by steepening the banks of this pond that you've been talking about, there's about 25,000 square feet of saving, 50,000 square feet, and that means about $25,000.
For the liner.
Yeah. So for the liner, liner of the pond. It might be worth saying why we need a pond. I mean, that's probably not obvious to everyone. When you have very low flows, you need a flywheel effect to store energy when you don't use it, so that you can have it when you really use it, and that's what a pond is. What a pond does. So we looked all over for a pond, and we thought we could use the tailings, but the tailings have disadvantages, and this rock pile seems to be the answer.
Yeah, nobody would smile on us if we had a big pond on the tailings and it broke loose and hauled a few hundred or a thousand tons of tailings down the river. We'd probably all try to sneak up over the pass and disappear into the sunset forever. All right. Now, do you have some burning questions, or does any of the other committee members want to make any statements for which you hold to be responsible for?
7 minutes left.
Will?
Yes. Dave?
We wrote down the projects that we work on in three categories. One is those that are critical to the continuation of the village, such as waste disposal. In a valley like this, that's a terrible problem. And the tailings, how did you refer to it, Werner?
I'm not sure which time, but...
curse and a blessing?
Well, yeah, the tailings almost now are a Christ figure to the future of the village, because they've allowed us to have a place for solid waste disposal and sewage disposal, and both of these could easily shut the village down by the county or state regulations if we didn't handle our solid waste and sewage properly. So the tailings at the same time are a source of pollution and also the source of our future existence. So
another category of project we work on are demonstration projects, and that water wheel is an example of that. It's not going to provide all the electricity the village needs, but it's sort of a neat application.
That's also our fish project.
Yes. That particular water wheel was designed by, built, I guess, by Herman Propp, who was, 94 or so?
Well, he's 110, but he lies about his age. Because he's still trying to find a wife.
He built projects like that for mission stations in New Guinea. So it has a practical application someplace.
Back in the late 1800s.
Yeah. Then the third category we work on is a sort of futuristic projects like the producer gas and so on. Our dream world.
How's the pigeon project coming?
Well, I'm sorry that you brought that up. That's one of my favorite projects, and because I
one of our failures.
It's one of the, when I get to be a dictator, every nursing home and every place like this will have a pigeon loft and have homing pigeons in, because I thought this was ideal. Carry messages. In fact, they're using them in a lot of big cities now. Pigeons are the best form of transportation for a lot of small messages or samples, like in London, going between hospitals and stuff. And they're really neat animals, and so we tried them out up here. They could carry messages from 25 mile creek and from down below, and also when you go out on a hike, two people are on a hike, you take a couple of those pigeons with you. If you have trouble, you send one of them back. If you're there too long, you eat the other one. We had all kinds of good ideas for them, and it really went well. We got a beautiful pigeon loft up here. But it's not Martin-proof. You heard the Martinizing clothes? Well, this is a different kind of Martin. They get in there, and what they don't kill, they shock to death. So that's, the pigeons went down the tubes, as it were, 2 years running. So I'm still going to hang in there. Maybe we can incorporate it in the loft of Chalet 1 or something. I haven't given up on this. And I'll keep... I'm glad you brought it up. The rest of the committee probably just soon did not. I'm going to keep pushing the pigeons. I'm going to have them in all the nursing homes in the state pretty soon. That's where all my girlfriends are. And